Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B.
Today's guest is Stephen Gillespie, 40 years of combination experience. Currently a battalion chief for the City of Goose Creek Fire Department in South Carolina. Retired lieutenant from the FDNY with over 21 years where he spent most of his time in the Bronx, including 13 years in special operations. Steve is a peer counselor for the Lowcountry Firefighter Support Team and gives one hell of a lecture on the topic of PTSD from his own experiences. With that, I present Mr. Stephen Gillespie.
I kind of grew up in the fire service. I've been around it ever since I can remember. My dad was a volunteer firefighter since I was about a year old. I grew up around a volunteer firehouse, and my dad's best friend, actually, it was a guy who lived across the street from us who was on the FDNY. My dad's best friend was FDNY. So when I was younger, it was the war years growing up in the 70s. And we used to listen to the Bearcat scanner with the old crystals in it. I'm really showing my age now. But we would hear a job come in, and I lived so close to New York City. I grew up right on the other side of the Hudson River from New York City. So we would hear a job in the Bronx or in Harlem, and my dad and I would go buff it. And then he would take me over there to visit his friends. And then when I was 17, you know, well, up until I was 17, I was hanging out at the volunteer firehouse. And then when I turned 17, I became a volunteer. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do in my life, Danny, was be a New York City fireman. So I was able to live that dream. So,
right. So you started at 17. You joined your first volunteer department, even though you know you've had experience around it with your dad. But once you joined it, what was that feeling like for you?
It was like it's hard to explain. It's like being a kid in a candy store, right? I was actually allowed, you know, to put the gear on and to go on calls. And, you know, being around it so much, it was just something I looked so much forward to. And when I was actually able to do it and to be able to actually say I was a fireman, which I really didn't know what that meant at the time. You know, the longer I went in my career, actually being a fireman is so much more than just having a t-shirt on.
Definitely. Okay. So, you know, you joined a volunteer department. You know, you're getting acclimated to the whole fire service thing. And you said your dream was to get on the FDNY. So can you explain to us how that process went about to get onto the greatest department in the world, in my opinion?
Yeah, it was 1986. I took the written test. Was it 86? I'm trying to think now. I think it was 87. Took the written test. It was the first test I was eligible for because you have to be 21. There were 40,000 people that took the written test.
That's crazy.
Got my score for the written test, and then I went for my physical agility test. And at the time, it still is. It's super, super competitive. If you didn't get 100 on a written and 100 on a physical, there was a good chance that they weren't even going to get to your number. So I got a 95 on a physical because I missed 100 by 4 seconds. And I think I got a 99 on a written. So I was kind of disappointed in myself and thought that they weren't going to get to my number. My list number was 2,671 off a 40,000 name list. And when you look at it that way, it's like the top 5 or 6%.
Right.
And the lists usually last 4 years. Once they come out with the list, it's good for 4 years. And my list was supposed to expire in May of 94. And I got hired in April of 94.
Wow.
So I just made it. So I was very happy when I finally got the letter. My dad called me up. He was at home. He opened it up and read it to me, and yeah, quite a bit of joy. So I was on my way. I was on my way to finally living my dream. So
Okay, so you get the letter, you're hyped, you're ready to go. What was first day at the Rock like?
the first day at the Rock was administrative stuff, you know.
Okay.
Even though I'd been around, I mean, I had hung around firehouses in the Bronx for a long time. I had never been to the Rock, so seeing what that was like, and you know, seeing it from the videos like Brothers in Battle, you know, where they videotaping stuff at the Rock, and just seeing those buildings and knowing what I was in store for, you know, and who I was going to learn from, and living a history of, you know, of the FDNY. It was overwhelming at times, really.
Can you explain to us how your I don't want to say rookie school. What do they call that when you're going through that
Proby
at the
school.
Proby school? Okay.
Proby school, yep.
Can you explain to us, you know, what you had to deal with, what that was like?
Yeah, they had it was 150 guys in my class. I think we wound up graduating 147, so three
Okay.
guys left for whatever reason. It's over 30 years ago now, which is hard to believe that it's been that long. But you know, normal everyday, so it wasn't as military formal as it is now. I wound up teaching a recruit class, a Proby school, in 1998. I was an instructor there, and it was much more regimented than it was when I went to Proby school. You know, my hair was longer than it is now, but I mean, I'm going to be 58, and I don't have much left. But it wasn't as military style as it was. You know, we had classroom sessions. We had, you know, we had hands-on training. You know, we were divided up by squads and companies, and that's how you went from class to class. It was pretty low key, and then you would hear a lot at the time. You know, I don't mean to at the time when I went through, the Rock was for some people who kind of didn't want to be out in the field, maybe. So the guys that you were learning from really weren't the most experienced guys.
Okay.
And everything that we were told was, wait till you get to your firehouse, you're going to learn something different. So, which I get kind of correlates to what it is now, is that, you know, you go to, you know, fire one or fire two, you learn how to pass a test. And then when you go out in the field, you kind of get taught little tricks and trades, you know, that are very different than what you did while you were in Proby school, or
Okay.
basic class, whatever it is that it's called.
Okay. So out of 150, 147 graduated, you're one of the 147. What was your first assignment? And were you happy to go there? Because you know, everybody has a place they want to go.
Yeah, so New York City Fire Department is very, I don't know what word do you have a hook, or you have a godfather, it's called, somebody that's going to take care of you and get you into a good firehouse. And I had that, or so I thought. I thought I had that, where a week before I graduated Proby school, I got a phone call that I was going to 42 Engine, which is a very busy single engine in the Bronx. And I was very excited that I was going to be able to go there. And then when the assignments came out a week later, I got assigned to 63 Engine, and I had no idea where that was. So th at the time, disappointed, yes. Went up there, not as busy as I wanted it to be, about 3,600 runs a year, which for FDNY standards is fairly slow. But I couldn't wait to get out of there. So I tried to get out of there. When I as a, I went on along in my career, 63 Engine is probably one of the busiest places in the Bronx, not maybe even a city now, just the amount of fire duty that they're doing up there. So it's all cyclical. You know, the South Bronx, they say, you know, moved forward, moved north, you know, and you know, the war years, it was all the South Bronx companies that were really busy. And as the fire duty moved north, you know, that's the busier companies became, you know, what they were. So.
And you were on FDNY during that era of the War Years, correct?
No. Well, no, that's
That
the
was.
war years. Yeah, that's like the 70s,
Okay.
70s and 80s. But that's where, you know, that's what I grew up around. You know, I
Okay.
grew up around, you know, reading Report from Engine Company 82, 20,000 Alarms, Ghetto Firefighter, you know, where all, you know, in the 70s, companies were doing 8, 9, 10,000 runs a year. You know, there were second sections of firehouses that were, they were so busy. Yeah, well, I didn't get on a job in that time, but that's what, you know, that what I knew about the job and what I thought it was going to be is, you know, that's that image that I had that of what firemen are supposed to be. You know, these salty, you know, salty guys with their Bronx bends and big mustaches and, you know, smoking a cigarette, you know, while they're inside the fire building, no, I got on much later on in my career in, 94 was I got where there was still a decent amount of fire
I was
duty.
going to ask, there was still amount.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Every decade kind of like there's in New York, nothing will beat the 70s. I will always be the busiest time in the city. The 80s was still very busy, but not as quite. The 90s was still busy, but not as quite. So, you know, it slowed down a little bit. But, you know, as the years went on, the fire duty kind of went down.
Okay. All right. And did you find yourself wanting to surround yourself with guys that were, you know, the quote being used now is into the job. Did you find yourself wanting to emulate people or individuals like that?
Yes, absolutely. And I wasn't finding that where I was. And I hate to talk bad about but that's what it was at the time. I had the captain at a firehouse was a War Years firefighter in the 70s and the 80s. And he kind of went up there to finish his career. Wealth of knowledge, learned a lot from the guy, but wasn't able to get the experience for. We would talk about a lot of stuff, but we weren't doing a fire duty where he could show you how to do it. One of my lieutenants was always drilling with us all the time. But then what I knew about the fire department from hanging around other firehouses wasn't exactly what I was looking for. So I was looking for something else. So,
And so
but again, now it's one of the busiest places. You know, there's a couple of guys from Rockland that we might even that Bobby Legros, you know name Bobby
no,
Legros? Yeah, he's from Rockland County.
Okay.
He's in 63 inch. I might be in 39 truck now, but he owns his own training company as well. But you know, that's one definitely one of the places to be now. It wasn't when I was there,
But
but
now it
now it
is.
is. Yeah.
That's funny how that
Yeah, I tried to
cycle.
go back as a lieutenant, but the demand there was, you know, everybody wanted to go there.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So I'm assuming, you know, you learned what you could from the individuals at that station. And I'm assuming you put in to go somewhere else or bid or whatever they call it. So where was your next assignment?
So it kind of worked out differently. I put in for transfers, whatever I could, and looking back at it now, it wasn't. I just wanted to get out of there, so I would put down the transfer order that you would fill out had four companies that you were able to put, you know, first choice, second choice, third choice, you know. And when I learned, you know, later on, you know, nobody wants to be your third or fourth choice. You know, you want to be able to, you know, you want to go to one place and that's what the people there are looking for from you is that this is the only place that you wanted to go to be dedicated to that one company, not just, you know, picking a couple out of a hat. So I put 42 engine back down again after a transfer order or two. And what wound up happening was I had the opportunity to go to engine 41, which wound up becoming squad 41. So at the time it was called enhanced engine 41. And there's a whole long story, Danny, about how they closed the firehouse in 1989 due to budget cuts. And the neighborhood was able to get the firehouse reopened in 1990. And when they reopened them, it was going to be a special unit. At first, it was going to be a rescue company, because at the time, there was no rescue and there was no special unit in the Bronx. Rescue 3 was still up in Washington Heights. They covered the Bronx, but they weren't stationed in the Bronx. And then there was going to be Squad 2, because at the time, there was only Squad 1 in Brooklyn. But because of all the court documents that said Engine 4-1, they didn't change the name of the company. They just changed what they did. So they called it Enhanced Engine 4-1. It was a squad company. We had the yellow front pieces. And in New York, a squad company has first, second, and third due engine assignments. And then above that, 1075 work and fire, you go on to all work and fires in the area. And the response area of Squad 41 is tremendous. It's the south half of the Bronx and the north half of Manhattan. Could be over in Harlem in minutes, which is where there was still a lot of fire duty. And I had the opportunity to go there very young. I probably didn't belong there. Not probably. I definitely didn't belong there. But I was given the opportunity to do it, so I had to take advantage of it.
Okay.
So I wound up going to Enhanced Engine 4-1 with about 2 years on the job. So,
and I'm sure once there, you had to learn all the different specialties of that company, correct?
Yeah, at first we just, you know, more fire duty stuff, because again, we were doing some technical rescue stuff, not as much as they do now. Pretty much at the time in 1996, when I got there, you know, 90% of what we did was fire duty and it was truck work. Cause most of the time the fires that we went to were squad boxes. So 90 to 95% of the time you were doing truck work. And a squad has dual assignments where you have an engine assignment and then a squad assignment. So if you were assigned, if you had the nozzle, for an engine assignment, then you had the hook if we went on a squad box.
Okay.
So, and again, there's still a good amount of fire duty in the South Bronx and Harlem. And just the response area that it was, and I say this not to brag, but just to tell the quality of guys that I worked with when I got there. My first night tour in 41, from 6 o'clock at night till 9 o'clock in the morning, in 15 hours, we went to six jobs and worked at four of them. So it was just, I was just immersed in it as soon as I got there. So a little overwhelmed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys were great and they were willing to teach me and I was willing to learn. So definitely had the opportunity to learn a lot.
In your opinion, how important is that to have coming in as a new person, whether you're a rookie or a transfer that's been on a couple of years? How important is it for, and you, especially now, because you know the saying, a lot of, you know, a lot of the mantra from the fire service is, you know, this new generation, this, that, and the other. But
yeah,
how important is it to, once that individual comes on, to show them what you want them to know, like to be that mentor?
I think that I try and do this now because I'm having this exact conversation in my position now, because I'm going to be 58 years old next week, you know, and I got guys that are literally half my age, and trying to explain to them, you know, what the job is about. And, you know, it was pretty much, this is what we do. If you don't want to do this, there's a door, you know, so you went there because you wanted to. It was a special unit where you had to go for a trial period And if it didn't work out, they sent you back. And I didn't want to go back. So I was going to do whatever it was that I needed to do in order to stay there. And, eyes and ears open and mouth shut. When they tell you to do something, that's what you do. And trying to deal with the generations today that they want to know why. I have no problem telling you why, but I think that the generation that taught me was just like, just shut up and do it, and if you didn't do it, you didn't, then they got rid of you, where we have to blend styles. I did a lot of teaching later on in my career, and then trying to get people to understand why. And when you're able to, why do you vent this way instead of this way? Why do you vent the top of the window instead of the bottom of the window? Why do you put the fork end, this way on a door as opposed to this way on a door? And to get them to understand that part, because a lot of young kids nowadays don't have mechanical skills that, I mean, I didn't have a lot of mechanical skills either. But, and nowadays you have to show somebody how to start a chainsaw, which they might have never done before.
But it's on that individual, because I mean, that was me. I didn't really know how to start a chainsaw. I was shown, and so I feel like whenever you have, newer people coming in, like it's not a belittlement thing. It shouldn't be. It should be, oh, you don't know how to, okay, that's fine. We'll show you, because I was shown.
I think that's what some of the people I worked with were very hard on me, and there were other ones that were. Everybody wanted to share their information. They all shared it in a different way. I had people that were very, very hard on me, which I was listening to what they say, might not have grabbed. I'm a visual learner, so I had to do it. What that taught me from those guys, I learned a ton from those guys. What it also taught me was that that's not the kind of mentor or firefighter that I want to be. Educate me, don't berate me. Because most people, as soon as it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And when you start screaming and yelling at people for not knowing how to do something that they might have never done before, that's not their fault, and then you totally lose them. I can't get mad at it. I found myself later on in my career becoming I don't want to say more of a senior guy after September 11th, trying to rebuild the company, becoming an officer later on, becoming a training captain in North Charleston, now as a battalion chief. I can't get mad at you because you don't know what it is that I told you to do. And I think I said that right. If I don't tell you this is what I expect of you, I can't get mad at you for not doing it. So here's what I expect. And that's what I found, again, where these guys were, this is what we do. And as I moved on in my career and got older and wiser, the way I relayed that was, this is what I expect of you. If you don't know how to do something, ask and we'll show you, or even show me how you do this so I can maybe show you a different way that might be, better. Because again, you have kids that go through fire one and fire two, they're taught how to pass the test, but it's very different when you're on a fire ground.
100%. Okay. All right. At what point in your career did you decide, like, I'm gonna go up for company officer? And the way I always kind of ask it is like your internal breaker within yourself, what tripped that made you go, all right, I'm gonna go for it?
I think my dad's best friend, who retired a battalion chief, my mentor in the FDNY, always promoted studying to get promoted. I had figured out again that the only thing I ever wanted to do in my life is that I got on a job at 27 and I could do 35 years till I was retired at 62, and I wanted to be at least a battalion chief. And I'm not a very smart guy. It took me 3 times to pass the lieutenant's test, but studying the manuals is what, and relaying it to what we actually do on a fire ground is what made me a better firefighter. So I had the drive to study to become a company officer. Just wasn't really good at taking the tests. So, I mean, I had 15 years as a fireman, 13 of them in Squad 41 when I got promoted to lieutenant. So, and still didn't feel like I was ready to become a company officer, just because my internal workings are, if I think that I'm good enough to do something, then I have nothing else to learn. So,
And
which
what
could
I
lead me
like,
down to, sorry.
no, what I like about it is it took you, it's not like it took you, but you waited 15 years. And even then, you were like, I'm still not ready for it. In this day and age now, 2024, with growing pains of departments, not enough applicants, you have individuals who are getting promoted sometimes to company officer with less than 5 years in on the job. I commend you for waiting that long because I'm not a company officer, but I waited 15 years to take the next step to what we call like our relief driver position because I was thoroughly enjoying the back seat,
Being a fireman.
being a fireman, getting to know my job. So what's your advice to anybody that's, maybe on the fence on whether or not they should get promoted?
Well, first, let me say it wasn't my choice that it took me 15 years to get promoted. I failed two lieutenant's tests and then I finally passed the third one that I took. So it wasn't by choice that I did that. But looking at the questions that you asked, I think it's very relative in a fire service that I'm in now in South Carolina, where when I worked as a training captain and now as a battalion chief. You might not have the time to be able to hone your craft, as a backstep firefighter, just because of the needs of the department and how small the department is, and turnover in South Carolina is and retention is a big problem in South Carolina in some departments. So constantly moving to the next position, where it took me 15 years to become a lieutenant. I know guys in this area that are battalion chiefs with 10 years on the job, and that's just the way that their career progressed. I think the unique thing about New York City is that you can choose to be a firefighter your entire career. There's no pressure on you to promote at all. In the firehouse that I retired out of, the senior man in the engine, senior firefighter, and the senior man in the ladder company in Ladder 59 both had over 40 years on the job when they retired, as firefighters, because that's what they wanted to do. And that's you're able to do that in a bigger department like that. In a smaller department, some departments you learn how to drive the fire truck in recruit school because that's a need that they have, is that, or as soon as you get to the company, that's one of the things that they start working in, showing you how to pump the truck because there might be a time where they need you to do that. And whether it's a good or bad thing, it's just something that's prevalent right now. And the advice that I would give to people is that just be open to learning what that is, and to take whatever training that you can and try to be the best firefighter that you can, and or whatever position that is. I always said learn up and teach down. As a senior firefighter, a mentor, a company officer, a training officer, even as a battalion chief, I feel it's my responsibility to pass my knowledge down to everybody because of the tremendous amount of knowledge that I got from the guys that I worked with. I mean, the guys that I worked with in 41 were phenomenal firemen that taught me so much about the job. And a lot of them that were senior firefighters to me wound up getting promoted, and a large majority of them wound up becoming officers in special operations and squad companies and rescue companies all throughout the city because of the experience that these guys had. So.
In your opinion, I genuinely want to hear what you think the cause is, but you mentioned it, retention, not really recruitment. I mean, we are having a recruitment issue. I mean, depending on the department, but what's your take on what can the fire service do better for retention?
Stop hiring everybody with a pulse. Be very, very honest. I don't think it's people like you and the people that you have on your podcast, Danny, are the kind of people that we don't have to worry about. Nobody strives, no, I'm not saying nobody, but somewhere it happened that people don't strive to become a firefighter anymore. The only thing I ever wanted to do was to be a fireman. And I did everything that I could. Every job I ever did was until I get on the fire department. I went to college until I got on the fire department. I was a police officer until I got on the fire department. I don't think that that drive is so prevalent now, where people don't strive for that position, because, and be brutally honest here, we give the job to people that don't want it. And somewhere along the line in this generation of what somebody told people that anybody could be a firefighter, and that is furthest from the truth. Not everybody could be a doctor, not everybody could be a lawyer, not everybody could be an airline pilot, not everybody should be a firefighter. And I think that in the fire service, we lowered some standards that allows people to lose their job in some fire department and just transfer to another one, because the retention problem is so bad that we just need asses in the seats. And we will hire guys that have been terminated from or been asked to leave, two or three other departments before, and they're not the best people.
No, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, a lot of I don't know if any chiefs listen to us, but it's one of those things. And I've even said it before in earlier episodes, like I would rather ride short than ride full, but have individuals that really don't care for the job. Because to me, those people are a liability that's just waiting to happen.
They're dangerous, right? They're dangerous. It's a team sport, Danny, and you try and I think that's where why a lot of guys have played team sports, and a lot of guys and military guys look towards the fire service as a career because of the team aspect of it, where what you do, other people are counting on you to be proficient at it. And to everything that we do on a fire ground is coordinated with what somebody else is doing. And when one person doesn't do their job or does something wrong, it could have a catastrophic effect on the fire ground. So we want the best people. We don't want to settle, And again, somewhere along the line, because it's a civil service job, or I have no Excuse me. I worked really hard to become a New York City fireman. But like down in South Carolina, and maybe where you are, you want to give your nephew a job or so, your they don't, it doesn't have to be the fire department. It could be with Public Works, or it could be with the Parks Department, or to get that good government job that, has health insurance and pays every 2 weeks and maybe even has a pension. at the end of your career. But there needs to be a distinction between that and the fire service, because we need the best possible people that we can to, to fulfill our mission to the public.
Definitely. With that being said, I'm going to ask you your opinion. What does the term aggressive mean to you?
And I wrote it down here as a description, from whatever, looking it up online. It's ready or likely to attack or confront. And I tried to relay that to, I think aggressive, it depends on who you ask. I think aggressive could be a good thing and aggressive could be a bad thing. And it depends. This is such a broad topic. I've been listening, trying to figure this out, how to answer this one question, Danny, because I know it's the one that you ask everybody. And aggressive doesn't have to be a negative thing. But when you look at it at this, likely to attack, what am I attacking or what am I confronting? I'd rather say, we all want to do an aggressive attack on a fire, aggressively attack the fire. Or we want to confront the fire. To me, it has to be, you can be very aggressive, but you have to be calculated in what it is that you do. I think the guys that get their bad names, for again, I'm old school, Danny. I'm going to be 58 next week, and I love going to a fire as much as the next guy, and I wish I could still ride a fire truck. But you can't just dive in windows and break every window you want because of, the science behind all of it. And I think the guys that get deemed aggressive might be from people in positions higher than them that really are uncomfortable with their own skills as firefighters. Where we talk about it earlier, guys rise in the ranks so fast. We have chiefs that may have not a lot of fire duty experience, and they're running a fire. And because they don't know what's capable of being done on a fire ground, or they've never done it before, they won't allow you to do that. So they coin these other guys that take classes, that study, that read, that are into the job, that understand what it is that we're supposed to do on a fire ground to save life and property. I think some people give that term aggressive to them a negative name, a negative twist, which sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. We need to be calculated, and I'm okay with you wanting to confront everything that's going on in front of you, but be calculated in it because, again, this is a team effort and we all rely on certain people to do certain things.
No, I well answered, and you dropped some facts. I mean, unfortunately, we do have chief officers that are in positions of leadership that have either never gotten that experience or have forgotten what I would say their roots, have forgotten what it's like being a backstep.
Yeah, it's definitely being at the battalion chief level now is it's looking at a 20,000 foot level now, as opposed to like when I was a fireman, I was only responsible for myself. All right. When I became a lieutenant, and you're a covering officer, you're now responsible for five firefighters who you just met them. You barely know their names. You have no idea what their capabilities are as firefighters, and you have to lead them into an environment that, you're counting on them being knowing how to do their job. And that totally turned changed my mindset from being a firefighter who was only responsible for myself to being a company officer now responsible for five guys. Now, as I become a chief officer, I'm responsible for everybody that's at the fire scene. And that's why I went into training so much, because I wanted to be able to pass on what was taught to me so that everybody on the fire ground knew what they were supposed to do in coordination with everybody, and be safe at this, you know, be aggressive and safe at the same time. You know, our job is to save life and property. And I have to be able to trust at a battalion chief level, be able to trust the people that are responding to this fire. I want to make sure that they know what it is that they're doing or what's, you know, what they're responsible for, and hope that they do it right. So I think I answered the question if there was a
Nope,
question there
you're
somewhere.
good. You're good. You're good.
Like I said, I can ramble sometimes, Danny.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm gonna kind of switch it to because we're kind of on the topic leadership. There's a lot of opinions on leadership within the fire service, and there have been really good examples and really bad examples, you know, of leadership in the fire service here recently, as well. So, what's your take for me? So, here's my question I'm asking you. If an individual is going to go for a company officer position, what do they need to remember about that position? Like, what comes with leadership?
I think first of all is that as a leader, you work for the people underneath you, right? They are your responsibility, so you have to make sure that they have everything that they need to be able to do their job. And that could mean a lot of different things, where you have to know their job as well as your job. And how did you learn that? Or did you learn that as you progressed through the ranks? You know, for it's a tough question because it has a the fire service has a lot to do with your reputation, you know, and where you came from and where you worked and what other people thought about you. And again, if you're in a small department and you were an asshole as a fireman, it's a pretty good chance you're going to be an ass even more of an asshole as a boss. You're not going to have the trust of the people that you worked with as firefighters, and now that you're in charge of them, it's going to be even less. So you're behind the eight ball right off the bat. So I think the biggest thing about being a good boss and being a good leader is leading by example. You know, don't ever ask somebody to do something that you wouldn't do yourself. You know, there's nothing below you that, you know, I still take out the garbage and mop the floor, you know, even though I got 40 years in the fire service and I'm a battalion chief. You know, that could be a bad thing sometimes though, Danny, because then the young guys think that they don't have to do those things because the chief will get it.
Right,
And
right.
that's something that we have to work with in the fire service, where tell them that this is what they're responsible for. You know, and they need to get this done, you know, not just stand around and watch other people. So I think I think I answered the question.
No, you're good. You're good. With that being said, you said earlier you always saw yourself retiring out as a battalion chief with the FDNY, and that didn't occur. But with you being a battalion chief now, in down in South Carolina, how has that dynamic been? Because to be blunt, there's no place like New York City. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, there's no other place that can replicate New York City. So when you got into that position, was it like a was a little bit of a culture shock for you, a little bit of a learning curve?
Both. Moving down here, it was nothing like New York City. And the culture shock of it, you know, everything that we did in New York was, you know, we showed up with 100 people. You
Okay.
know, I got, you know, when you say it's a five-man engine, you know, it's actually six guys on a fire truck because the officer, you know, isn't counted in the manpower in New York. You know, every engine has at least four firefighters, Every ladder, squad, and rescue has five firefighters plus an officer. So now I come down to South Carolina and there's three guys on a truck, and the boss is a working boss, and that concept of, where I come from, I was management and I didn't do anything. I never touched the tool anymore. I never stretched the line anymore. And inside the firehouse, the guys did everything for us as a boss. They cook your meal, they clean your office, they make your bed, they clean your shitter. They do literally do everything for you, but you're responsible for them overall. And then coming down here where the officer has to do everything on the fire ground as well, it was definitely a culture shock. I think again that the things that I came down here with was my knowledge and what I thought about myself as far as my experience as a firefighter, because when I came down to South Carolina, it was a very different type of firefighting. I've never cut a peaked roof in my entire life, let alone a peaked roof on lightweight construction. I've cut hundreds of peaked roofs. I mean, I'm sorry, hundreds of flat roofs in New York, which were, anywhere from 2 to 5 inches thick, just because there was so many roofs rolled over on, they just put a new roof on top of an old one instead of ripping it down. The type of firefighting I did was very different because it was multiple dwellings and not private dwellings, and only showing up with six guys, sometimes less at a fire, and learning how the basics still have to get done and how to do it with the limited amount of people. And then that was a struggle to try and get people to understand, the basics are the same. We protect life, life, incident stabilization, and property conservation, LIP. Where the hose line goes, it goes, LECE. Goes to protect life first, then the exposure, then confine, then extinguish the fire, right? And getting people to understand that, I'm getting into a little bit of tactics, that 90% of the time, the first hose line should go to the front door of a private dwelling, no matter where the fire is, to protect life, because that's going to be their means of egress. That doesn't necessarily mean that line might put the fire out sometimes. Another line might go to where the fire is and actually put it out. But that first line is protecting life, and whatever. Sometimes I don't want to get too far in the tactics again, but again, it's a very different type of firefighting. And I learned a lot in the 8 years that I've been down here about how to fight fires in private dwellings with limited manpower. But I think my experience from New York with other things about fire behavior and the skills needed to do those things is what I came here with and was able to pass on. And I'm not afraid to tell you that I don't know how to do something. When I was a training officer and we were doing vertical ventilation, I was not the guy to teach you how to do that because I had never done it before. But I made sure that I vetted some of the instructors who knew how to do that skill, and learned from them so that I could teach it at a later time. So definitely a culture shock though, Danny.
I can imagine. I can imagine. I do have a question, and I'm sure some of the listeners probably would want me to ask this. So when you're a boss in New York City, you said you don't really, you're not counted as a part of manpower, but let's just say I was a boss and I wanted to get involved. Is that allowed or is that not allowed?
I'd say it's different, right? So a boss in the engine is going to be right next to the nozzle man. Okay. He's not going to have the nozzle. And if the nozzle man runs out of air, then the backup guy is going to move up and take his position. And then if he runs out of air, then the door and control and vice versa, or you're going to get relieved by another company. You're not going to have the nozzle as an officer in an engine company. In a ladder company, it's a little different. With the can man and the irons man, you can split that team up, have the can man to be the junior firefighter and a more senior firefighter have the irons, where once you make it into an apartment, you guys can split up. You can take the can man with you and you're actually doing a search.
Okay.
So the truck officers do more stuff like that than the engine officers do. So, but you're not going to force a door. They won't allow it. The guys won't allow that. The guys who have pride in their company and pride in their skills won't allow you to do it anymore. And they will tell you, if you still wanted to force a door, then you should have never got promoted. That's not your job anymore.
That's crazy. But would there ever be a situation where, hey, like the irons are on the floor, there's a door here, and you can quickly force it?
Don't let anybody see it happen. there's scenarios where anything could happen.
Right.
You know, but that wasn't you become a supervisor in that position. And again, where, you know, the difference between an engine and the ladder company, and which is why I like the progression of going an engine first to a ladder company later, is that an engine company sticks together the whole time and you learn that whole team concept, you know, and then you can see then when you go to the ladder company, you wind up getting the can first or you're on the inside first. So you can learn what happens inside and you can see, you know, what you did during the engine at the engine time when you're in the engine, how that relates to what the truck guys on the inside team are doing now. And then as you get more experience, you move to the roof and then you get to see the benefit of vertical ventilation where somebody opens up a skylight or a bulkhead or vents the roof and you watch the fire lift, you know, and to see that as an engine man is an awesome thing, you know. And then eventually probably the hardest in New York is the most senior guys are the OV and the chauffeur, you know, who those other three guys all work individually as opposed to the inside team and the engine all working together.
Okay. And as far as if you're a boss on one of the squads, on one of the
same thing, you pretty much up on a squad. If we're an engine, again, you're operating as an engine. You know, if we're the way we did it in 41 was that there were two teams, there was an inside team and an outside team. So the officer had the hook and the irons. They always stayed together. And then the other two guys were the roof and the saw, and they stayed together and they were an exterior team. And then the chauffeur could kind of go wherever he thought was necessary, whether he wanted to meet up with the inside team or if it was an upper floor fire and the guys needed help with ventilation on the roof. You kind of got to pick and choose wherever you wanted to go.
Okay. And what about the rescue, like the five individual
rescues? Same thing.
Same thing.
Same thing. They operate. Yep. They operate as a truck. Rescue operated a little differently. Send two guys to the fire floor, two guys to the floor above. But again, it was rescue did truck work.
Okay.
So, and I thought that was always a nice thing. Like, the motto of Squad 41 was best of both worlds, because we did engine work and we did truck work.
Mm-hmm.
And then our response area was the South Bronx and Harlem, which were two busy areas in New York City. And I never had the desire to go, you know, they make jokes all the time. They call us the JV, you know, squads are the JV and the rescue is the varsity.
Varsity, yeah.
You know, I never had a desire to go to rescue for a couple of different reasons. First, I was a seated chauffeur and I really liked driving. I liked the responsibility of being able to get the guys safely to a fire, wherever it was that we were going. And geographically, you had to know your response area. And it was just a huge part. It was, again, the south half of the Bronx and the north half of Manhattan was geographically a really big area. And knowing the best ways and how to get to certain places, you know, you'd hear a street come in and you know who was first due and how to start, you know, how to start heading that way the quickest way. The other part of it was I really like doing both things. You know, I'm an engine man at heart, you know, the knob's the job. It's the greatest position, you know, on the fire ground. And I just love doing the engine side of it too. So I like doing both.
And as far as with you driving, at least back then, I'm not sure if it's changed. Were there map books or were there computerized that would give you turn by turn directions, or was it up to the driver to kind of get to know how to get
Yeah,
there?
You kind of had to, as we went on, smartphones were, I got promoted in 2009. So, and I'm still not good with, my 17-year-old knows more about that stuff, but I knew the Bronx pretty well, just from hanging out in the Bronx so much. Manhattan was a little bit easier because, streets ran east and west, and avenues ran north and south. It was learning the street names that, but for me, it was just knowing a map, being, the buff that I am, knowing where the companies were located. And when you heard, 82 engine give a 1075, you kind of knew where you were going. Or you heard 69 engine give a 1075 in Harlem, you kind of knew the direction that you were going. So, once we got, I would always look on, we had a big map right next to where, right next to the driver's, the chauffeur's door. So you can look at the map and see, but, nowadays the computers have GPS on them. As it went on later in my time as being a driver, other guys started using their phones more often, with GPS, but that's not the, that was something that I really prided myself on, again, as a seated chauffeur, is to be able, that I knew the streets and I knew, the nuances of the boroughs.
And there's nothing like driving in New York City traffic.
I loved it. I loved it.
Do you really? You did. Code three. Golly.
It's it was funny when I got promoted, about a week after I was out in the field, I called the two officers that I drove. I would drive one of two officers all the time, and I called them up and apologized for my erratic driving over there, and told them I can understand why they have such gray hair because of my driving. So.
I know one big topic we mentioned earlier before we started, and we're on it now, the mental health aspect of it. And for I just want to give a little context to the listeners that I sat in your presentation that you did over at the in Carolina that we had, and I thought hands down it was one of the best. And I'm not saying it because you're on here, I'm trying to fluff you
Yes,
up,
you
like
are. Yes, you
it's
are.
100% genuine. Like, that was a hell of a presentation, that especially when it came to the mental health aspect side. So I want you to have the floor on that topic.
Thank, I appreciate you saying that, Danny, but yeah, that has a my mental health has a lot to do with why I decided to retire. Just some context. I lost six guys from my firehouse on September 11th. I mean, you know my story. I was at the Black Sunday fire where six guys had to jump out the top floor window. A year and a half after that, I went to another fire on August 18th, 2006. I'm sorry, August 27th, 2006, where a lieutenant in Proby died. And then less than a year after that fire on August 18th, 2007, I went to another fire where two firefighters died. So in a course of less than 3 years, I wound up going to three different fires where two firefighters died at each fire. And it's not just those three things. I mean, I've been a first responder since I'm 17, and I think that mental health awareness came so much more apparent in the FDNY after September 11th, just because we were overwhelmed with everything that was going on. And I started to get some help, which a lot of us did. I realized that I was struggling with a lot of things. Mental health is a really tough thing for us to talk about as first responders, because we're tough guys, and we don't want anybody to see that we're weak, which I think is the exact opposite. And through therapy and medication, I was able to to try and get myself on the right track. But it really wasn't until I retired and removed myself from New York that I realized how bad I was really struggling, and got involved with a peer support group down here in South Carolina, which led me to this soapbox that I'm on now about mental health. and trying to get guys to understand that there's resources available, and trying to throw out the cultural competency, it's called, where you can trust me because you know that I've been through what it is that you're going through, or I can tell you that I know exactly how you're feeling and probably even tell you how you're feeling, before you realize it, as opposed to, I don't want to talk to some therapist because they have no idea what it is that I'm talking about. But being able to get peers and then people trained to be able to deal with the traumatic stuff that we deal with, it's super, super important. I mean, we take care of our physical health in recruit school. We do skills to take care of our skills. But we don't do anything to talk about our mental health. It's starting to come into academies now, even financial health now too. Some academies are putting in financial classes to teach these young 18 and 20-year-old kids that might have never had a job before how to deal with money. But mental health is like my passion now, and I will speak to anybody that will listen. I was fortunate enough to be asked to do it at training days in North Carolina, and I'm glad you found found some good in that, and I appreciate the good words that you said. But that's it. It's my presentation is from the heart, man. It is really my struggles over, over 40 years of dealing with stuff from the time I was a 17-year-old volunteer firefighter till things that even happen now since I retired. So, yeah, but we need to take care of ourselves. If we're not good ourselves, then we can't be good for anybody else, for our families, our wives, our children, our husbands, our coworkers. You know when somebody isn't right. And again, if they don't have their head in the game and they do something on the fire ground, could be detrimental to everybody else that's there. So, just trying to get that stigma away. And then talking about, I related to the box that we have inside our head, a file folder, whatever it is that you call, whatever it is that anybody calls it, it just gets built up with trauma. And when you don't release it, it starts to overflow. And that's when the really bad stuff starts happening. But as you start to speak about the things that are in your head and the things that we've seen over our career, it makes it easier to deal with. You learn how to remember without reliving some things. It's never going to go away. You just learn how to live with it. And by therapy and medication and some other treat, EMDR, immersion therapy. There's a whole bunch of different things that are available nowadays, and I think that's probably one of the biggest things is getting firefighters to realize that there's a tremendous amount of resources available to us. They just need to know where to look for them.
100%. And I think we have, meaning the fire service has made strides in burning that stigma. You have various podcasts out there where individuals will talk about it. I see it a lot too in the conferences being held. They always set aside for a speaker to talk about it. You got Next Rung out there with Blake Stinnett doing really good things. Dean Ali and Raleigh just doing awesome things as well. So I think it's making its way around areas. But of course, we're still gonna have those what I call certified badasses that are like, oh, what, you had a problem with this call? Oh, you need to toughen up or leave your
Yeah,
feelings at the
absolutely.
door, whatever
Absolutely.
the hell, that they use. But I like I said, I think with what you're doing, because your presentation was, because I mean, you sit there and think about it, to see and live through the experiences that you shared with us. Like, it will take a toll regardless. I don't care who you are. At some point, your cup overfills and you're going to reach your limit.
Absolutely. And again, that's, we have the platform to be able to do that now. Again, I'm willing to speak to anybody that that want to listen. It's and going back to what you just said, yeah, there's still people out there that are like, you know, suck it up, kid, you know, and that's the way I was brought up, you know. You know, that's the way it used to be, but we need to make it more acceptable now. And I think that one of the big things, especially about being a really good leader, is you have to show that humility to your people to be able to let them see that, hey, this bothered me too, but this is how I dealt with that. So, and then you being that mentor to those people, they say, you know, the guys that look up to you on your job go, you know, hey, you know, if Danny's struggling, then it must be okay. You know, and if Danny's going to get help, then it must be okay. You know, and being that mentor to the younger guys and to take that stigma away and for guys to be able to realize that, you know, it's okay. It's okay to not be okay.
Right.
You know,
Right.
but you have to take that step to be able to realize that. You want to try and do it before other people tell you how bad you are, which is happened to me before. You don't want to be the last to know. And being able to reach out to some people, say, hey, listen, I'm struggling, you know, can you help me with whatever it is. So
Okay. I have two questions before we wrap up the conversation, because I've always wanted to know this. After you retired, you know, long life New Yorker, why South Carolina? Was it like you just I'm gonna throw a dart at a map and wherever it lands, it goes, or like how did South Carolina come about?
to be honest with you, I wound up doing exactly what I wanted to move to South Carolina for better weather, for cheaper cost of living. I wanted to become a training officer in a smaller department, but and I wanted to be part of somebody's staff. I didn't want to be the training chief and the only guy. And when I wound up getting a job with North Charleston, that's exactly what it was. You know, it's a North Charleston is close to 300 man department. 13 set 14 stations now, 13. And I was part of they were expanding their training division and I had the opportunity through a friend who was working for North Charles to say, hey, you know, we're advertising this position. I think it would be a good thing for you. So it all kind of fell into place. You know, that I wound up we talked about moving to South Carolina. I wanted to be a training officer, but didn't want to be the number one guy, just be part of somebody's staff. So
All right.
But there's too many Yankees moving down here now,
There are a
Danny. They're
lot.
ruining it for everybody
I
else.
know, trust me, I hear it all the time at work that
Yeah,
they're like,
now we're
you
damn
damn
Yankees.
Yankees. Yeah, I've heard that plenty of times too. Your people are coming down here. And it's like,
Yeah,
I
I
don't know
learned a
what to
couple of
tell you.
things. Y'all is singular, all y'all is plural, and bless your heart is not a good thing. So.
Last question for you.
Yeah.
Where do you see yourself? Where do you see yourself? When I mean where, I mean position, rank, and when do you see yourself just going, all right, I'm done. I'm hanging it up for good.
I got to be totally honest with you. The thought have crossed my mind many a times before. I actually took a little hiatus for about a year. recently, I was at Goose Creek for a year, and then I was gone for a year, and now I'm back again. But my plan is, again, I probably said it numerous because I have a 17-year-old son. He's a junior in high school. I never wanted to work past 60. So the plan right now is kind of when he's done with high school, depending on where he goes to college, that's when I'm going to call it quits. So,
Gotcha. And for good.
and yeah, for good. And then I'm going to travel with my wife, hopefully, and go see some sites and stuff. So, or
Awesome.
whatever she tells me we're going to do.
Yep, because
So,
they're usually the boss. So trust me, I
that's
understand
right. That's
that.
right.
I understand that. I just called to you because that's just the way I do it. Chief, I really do appreciate you coming on, spreading the good word. Talking positively, helping others within the fire service, and share your experiences. I'll talk to anybody, but I will especially talk to anybody that was part of what I say is the greatest fire department in the world. So I just want to say thank you for coming on. And I was very fortunate to go to training days and hear and witness and watch your presentation. And it was phenomenal. So I just want to say thank you for coming on and, you know, spreading the good word.
Thank you, Danny. I appreciate you having me on and being able to talk about this stuff. You are doing a really good thing by having these forums for guys like us who are able to come on and spread the word. So thank you for reaching out to me to asking me to do this. I truly, it's my honor.
Well, I appreciate it. You have yourself a wonderful day.
All right, Danny, you too. Take care.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.